This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're doing family law, starting with planning to get married. Are you planning to get married? And if so, do you have a prenuptial agreement? We'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about other ways to protect your assets if you're not going to have a prenuptial agreement. My guest is Christopher Melcher, chair-elect of the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. He's a certified family law specialist, partner in the Woodland Hills, that's Los Angeles County law firm of Walzer and Melcher. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, which has about 3,800 members of the section. Additional funding is provided by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you here. You know, who should get a prenuptial agreement?
Well, these are usually for people who have some family wealth that they want to protect, and also for professionals, lawyers, doctors who are thinking about getting married, and just because of the way that those practices are valued in a divorce is not really based on fair market value. So we can avoid some of those results through a prenup.
What about the average person?
You know, it is a pretty expensive process to go through, considering all the other expenses that somebody is paying for with a wedding. So, you know, these are usually for wealthy people or for children of you know, wealthy parents who want their children to have a prenup, again, because of the costs involved. I mean, I think everyone can benefit from having a premarital agreement, or at least going through the process of discussing the financial expectations that they have from the marriage. And that's what I see really the failure of a lot of couples is they talk about things other than these financial expectations. Who's going to work? Who's going to stay at home? What if they have children? How are those things going to change? What if they ever did get divorced? What would be community? What would be separate? would support be paid? And even if they don't want to have a formalized agreement, they should at least be talking about those things before they get married.
How do you get them, though, Chris, to do that? Because most people, I think, in terms of talking about things like, well, what happens if we get divorced? Will I have to go back to work? Assuming this is the potential wife who's saying this. What about spousal support? Things that obviously start having red flags waving. How do you get them to do this, to feel comfortable enough to do this? What suggestions do you have after you're practicing nearly 20 years doing this stuff?
Well, I agree. No one wants to talk about, divorce, death, taxes. These are all things that we want to avoid. But we don't have to talk about, or the couple doesn't have to talk about what would happen in the event of the divorce. They can talk about what's going to happen during their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I see clients coming in who had expectations that say their partner was going to work during the whole marriage. And when that partner decided to retire or work part-time, it ripped in a relationship where one felt that, you know, they were working and doing more than the other. And, you know, if that had been talked out earlier before they got married, then maybe those expectations would have been adjusted, or at least they knew what they were getting into before they said, I do.
Is there some kind of professional, and this is not an area of the law that really I've had any experience in at all, other than very early in my legal career, is there some professional who you feel if people, potential married couples, want to spend a little money to try to get some professional help, is there someone that they can go to who might be competent enough to help them explore these areas and help them to have a better realization of what the future holds?
Sure. There's marriage and family therapists, or MFTs, who deal with these issues all the time. And
do you recommend that most people who are not wealthy think about agreeing to pay to do something like this?
I absolutely do. I think that the more educated we are about what these relationships involve, the better off we're going to be, the more successful they're going to be. Because, again, it until we start talking, communicating with the other person, we don't really know what their vision of marriage is or domestic partnership. We have to communicate. We have to get that out of them because we tend to assume that everyone thinks the way that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wants what we want, but
mm-hmm.
that's just not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to find a way to get that information out. And it may just be as simple as just talking to your partner. But if you need some help facilitating that kind of conversation, then a therapist can be helpful. And there's nothing negative about that. That's just, again, trying to open those lines of communication to build a stronger relationship so we know what we're getting into when we make this very, very serious commitment.
Is there or are there any consumer books that you would recommend that someone who is thinking about getting married might pick up to read and kind of try to educate themselves about issues that they should be thinking about?
There's a great book called Prenups for Lovers, A Romantic Guide to Prenuptial Agreements by Arlene Dubin, U-B-I-N. And
D-U-G-I-N?
D-U-B as in boy.
Boy, okay, thank you.
And Prenups for Lovers, she's an attorney and wrote this book and really goes through the advice of how to talk about these financial expectations. And again, this is a conversation that all couples should be having with each other, whether they're going to formalize something in writing or not. But she talks about ways to open up these conversations with your partner before marriage and how that can actually strengthen the relationship by having that communication up front rather than going into a marriage and later on realizing that somebody else's dream is not your own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what you're telling us, I think, is that we need to have or try to have really good communication with our potential lifetime partner.
That's what it is.
Before we close or tie the knot, huh?
That's what it really is. It's a partnership, and just like if you were going into business with somebody, you'd want to talk about the future and what could happen. What if things unexpected, you know, come up, disability or people wanting to do something different. These are kind of things that if we were going into business with somebody, we would probably talk about and maybe even formalize. But in a marriage, a lot of times, like I say, people just assume, well, you know, my partner must be thinking what I'm thinking and everything's going to work out fine.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to have that communication because most of the marriages that I see fail because of a lack of communication and a lack of appreciation for what the other one does. And if somebody is going into a marriage thinking, okay, we're going to have kids and I'm going to work and my wife's going to stay at home and take care of the kids, you know, again, we have to have that conversation with the other partner to see, is that really what she wants? And if that's the trade that's made, both of those partners have to respect that and value those contributions that are being made, because once they are feeling unappreciated, it can lead to a lot of resentment in the relationship.
You mentioned that a prenuptial agreement can be rather expensive. What if we, and I certainly want to be including people who are of middle income in our conversation on this program. What if with the financial situation as it is in this state, in this country, with the incredible debt that California has, and who knows if the United States, depending on what Congress does, can even meet its debts in the not-too-distant future, you know, the way they're talking. But for most people, people are struggling just to get by. And a lot of people who own homes may now find that their homes, the value, are lesser than the mortgages on the homes. What if we have people who are not rich, but who have let's say, separate property, maybe it is a home when they get married. How do you suggest to them that they deal with the issue if one party has a home, let's say not fully paid for, because most people don't, most middle-income people don't have a fully paid-for home, especially when they're young, and how should they, would you suggest they deal with something like that? Because when they do get married, the continued payments on the mortgage are going to be made from community property under California law. So what suggestions do you have if someone feels he or she should try to protect that separate property in the home? How do you suggest they go about dealing with that?
The law already has rules here for people who get married without a prenup, which is most of us. I mean, the overwhelming majority of people do not have a prenup, and the law already tells us how to deal with those marriages. And anything that we owned prior to marriage is our separate property. And just because we marry somebody doesn't automatically convert or change that into community property. So if there is a premarital home, or maybe there's an interest in a pension from work or an inheritance, whatever it is, bank account, that's all going to be separate property. And as long as we keep it separate, you know, we don't mix in our earnings during marriage, it's going to be confirmed to us 100% on a divorce. Now, in that home example, like you mentioned, there's a mortgage on it. And when the principal payments are made on the mortgage out of the income of one of the spouses during marriage, well, now the community is paying for a separate asset. And so the community would get reimbursed for those principal payments and would get a share of the appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's
mm-hmm.
a fairly simple formula for mm-hmm. figuring that out. But the property still remains separate. The problem that people face, though, is when they want to refinance. And when they're married and they want to refinance, the lender, title company, escrow, somebody there is going to ask for it to be changed into joint names, which makes it community property, or for the non-owner spouse to sign what's called a quick claim deed, acknowledging that he or she has no interest in that home.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of couples, happily married, they're going through the refi, they just figure, hey, well, I'm going to go ahead and put it in joint names right now. Well, now they've converted that premarital asset into a community asset. And but it doesn't mean, though, that they've lost everything. They're going to be reimbursed for the equity in the home as of the date that they put it in joint names.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least they're going to get their equity back at the time they put it in joint names, and anything over that, in excess of that, would be divided 50-50 on a divorce.
You know, one of the things that you sent me a really nice memo of points for me to familiarize myself with before we went on the program. And one of the things you say in this, and of course I've been aware in California that there's a, I think the divorce rate is at least 50% at any one time. But you're talking about the potential for divorce, and you said something to the effect that the potential is 100%.
Well, every marriage will end. And
one way or another.
One way or the other. And every marriage ends, and under law, by either divorce or death. And so one of those things is absolutely going to occur. And most of the people, when they're doing a prenup or just thinking about getting married, they're more concerned about the divorce part of it and what would happen there. But on death, you know, we have a division of community property, all of these things that need to be dealt with then too. And so particularly for couples who have children from another marriage, you know, want to make sure that those children are protected. And we've seen cases where, you know, the stepmom or stepdad has got everything,
mm-hmm.
and the children from the other marriage were left with nothing. And, you know, if the stepmom or stepdad has a close relationship with those children and is going to continue providing for them after the death of the parent, then all is fine. But you know, sometimes that doesn't happen, and those children will get basically left out with nothing. So we have to be concerned about all the ways that a marriage can end, and make sure there's some planning there to take care of children from a prior marriage.
What about this? In a middle-income couple who finally gets to a point they just can't live with each other anymore, and let's say they have a child or children, and they've got a mortgage on a house, and community property has been used to pay at least a good portion of the mortgage. And they're thinking that, well, my lifestyle won't change. What can you tell us, at least in your experience, about what happens to the house where we have middle-income people who get divorced? Will the house end up finally having to be sold just because of the financial situation, so that really neither of them gets the house and they both end up having to live in an apartment?
Yeah, for most people, I mean, we're talking, except for very wealthy people, most of all of us, okay, a divorce is extremely disruptive. It's like nuclear war on the finances of that couple. And there is no way that they're going to be able to maintain their same lifestyle after a separation. You know, most of us are pooling resources. Maybe we have two income families, and we're doing the best that we can to get by. And if there were a separation, now we have to look at not only maintaining that one house that we have, but also now having a second place for the whatever partner is going to be moving out. And there's just not enough money to, you know, pay for these two separate residences and all the other costs that go along with it. So the parties have to then ratchet down their lifestyle significantly, and they're going to have to sell the house. Most people can't afford to keep the house after a divorce. So they're going to end up selling the house. They're going to move into apartments. They're going to wind up with gigantic debt because of, you know, attorney's fees or support that's being paid. And it is not a happy picture for anyone. And, you know, and I tell my clients when they're coming in an early stage, they haven't filed for divorce or maybe haven't told their spouse that they want a divorce, and I try to let them know what that picture is going to look like and have them compare it to what, you know, things that they're perceiving are going on wrong in their marriage right now, and to see that things can be a lot worse. I mean, you know, maybe dealing with hurt feelings at the moment in their marriage, but they could be dealing not only with those feelings being hurt, but also losing everything that they have. So, you know, some people will take that advice and reinvest into the relationship and try to make it work rather than basically ripping apart everything that they have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me just let the listeners know that this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about prenuptial agreements. We're talking about other ways to protect your assets. We're talking about things that really people who are about to get married, as well as people who are married, should really work on trying to have the best communication you can have with your partner, whether it's a heterosexual marriage or whether it's a gay or a lesbian partnership. These are things that are terribly important in terms of improving your communication. My guest is Chris Melcher. He's chair-elect of the Family Law Section of the State Bar, which is one of the major funders of this program. Chris is a certified family law specialist. He had to take at least a couple of bar exams, jump a number of hoops, have a lot of people saying he's a really good person and should get this certified specialist title, and so he's here with us. And for those of you who listen to the program live, we will be taking your calls in a few minutes. We are live in the Bay Area. We're also live on the internet for an hour at www.kalw.org. So if you have questions, we'll be getting to you in a few minutes. Chris, a lot of people, especially those who are having problems, middle income people having problems with each other, marriage or whether they're in a partnership, probably have too much credit card debt. What suggestions do you have about that?
Well, we do end up dividing a lot of debt these days.
Maybe not assets, but debt, huh?
Yeah, we used to divide assets. Now we divide debt. And credit cards are our problem area because, you know, we have the cards in our wallet. We also may have a number of accounts that are open that we just have forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've seen in numerous cases is either during a divorce or even after a divorce, the ex going and realizing, oh, wow, we have this other Visa account here that's in our joint names that has a $10,000 line of credit on it. And they'll call the bank and say, can you please send a new card to my address? And they will get that card and start charging on it.
Mm-hmm.
And now the other spouse, ex-spouse, is now obligated to the bank to pay that. The divorce judgment has no effect on the rights of creditors. If these two spouses had applied, you know, signed up for that card, they're jointly liable for either person's charges. Now, there may be the divorce court coming in there and saying that, well, whoever charged it should pay for it, but that's just a piece of paper ordering them to do that. They're never going to get their $10,000 back, and their credit's going to get ruined if they don't pay it themselves. So my advice is that, you know, if somebody's looking at, you know, possibly having a divorce happen, or if they've already had it happen, is to go run their credit and look at all those accounts. And if there are, you know, joint accounts out there with their ex, to go ahead and close those accounts down, to avoid this from happening. What's another option is that if the account has a balance on it, you know, the credit card company won't let you close the account until you pay it off. What you can do in that situation is ask the credit card company to lower the credit line to what is owed on it right now so that the other spouse can't charge anything on it. And these are just real practical things that we need to think through to protect the person from making this mess any worse than it already is.
Do you think that it's a good idea before people get married to by him or herself, sit down and on a piece of paper, write down those things that he or she thinks might be potential issues of conflict, and then at least put them down on paper, and then when the time is right, have a discussion with the other party about these issues from time to time? Or is that a little bit too schoolish?
Well, I think it's good to start thinking ahead on what could be the sources of conflict. You know, we'll see the home that's owned by one spouse before marriage, and then during marriage, they're living in this home. Well, the other spouse or partner may not feel that's really their home because they're not on title to it. And, you know, that may be very significant to that person to feel that they, you know, this is their home, they actually own it, and they're not just there at the pleasure of the other spouse. So, you know, that's something that, you know, should be talked about and say, you know, is that going to be an issue? And if it is, how do we work through it? If there are, you know, maybe one of the spouses has wealthy parents, and what are the expectations there? You know, are those parents going to pay for the, you know, children's education? You know, what if they don't do that? Is that going to be an issue? If they're working in a family business, are they going to get stock, or are they going to get fair compensation for their work in that business? And that can lead to a lot of problems because, you know, if they're there working for their family business and the other spouse is saying, well, hey, you know, you're out there, you could be making more money working elsewhere. They're, you know, they're paying you undervalue, and I'm getting the short end of this thing. So, again, it's just basically trying to look ahead and seeing what could be the sources of conflict and talking those things out, trying to work the solutions out to them ahead of time, because once you say I do, then you are locked into that relationship, and there are a lot of legal consequences involved. It's easy to get married, very difficult to get out of a marriage.
I think, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think there is a very significant percentage of people getting divorces who represent themselves? There are not attorneys. What percentage of people getting divorces are in that category, would you say?
Well, overwhelming majority of people are self-represented. Yeah. Most people cannot afford a lawyer.
Sure.
And what I think, though, that people should be, you know, thinking about is consulting with a lawyer. I mean, most of this stuff is not rocket science. I mean, if it's community property, you divide it in two. And, you know, there's a number of rules there. And I think that if somebody's going through a divorce, they should at least, you know, talk to a lawyer on the side, you know, cost a few hundred dollars to get some advice just to say, okay, am I, you know, filling out the right forms here? What can I expect and what's reasonable? Maybe reviewing an agreement before it's signed. That's money that's really well spent because there are so many crazy forms that we got to fill out and the process that we have to go through. There's a lot of good information if you go onto the California Courts website, which is a website created by the California court system. There is a ton of self-help information on there, and they'll tell you, you know, step by step what you need to do. All the forms are there. You can fill them out. Right there on your computer. So there's a lot of resources there. But, you know, it's good to sit down and talk to somebody, you know, an experienced family lawyer who can give some tips on, you know, what the particular issues in the case and how they can be resolved.
We have reached the end of the statewide version of the program. And let me give the court's website for those of you who may want to look at it and try to see what the forms are and educate yourself. www.courtinfo.ca.gov/self-help. www.courtinfo.ca.gov/self-help. Oh boy, I really messed that one up. Let me do it again. www.courtinfo.ca.gov/self-help. Also, as Chris was talking about, the book that you might want to take a look at is Prenups for Lovers by Dubin, D-U-B-I-N. And Chris, we'll be back to you in just a moment.
Thanks.
All right, it's about 7:27, actually 7:28 on the clock here at KALW. This is 91.7, your local public radio station, KALW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guest is Christopher Melcher, chair-elect of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. He's also a certified family law specialist. He's a partner in the Woodland Hills. That's in Los Angeles County, the northern part of the county. The law firm is Walzer and Melcher. If you have a question for Chris in the area of family law, and we won't just limit it to prenuptial agreements, you can ask any question that you'd like, and Chris will do his best to try to give you some general direction. The number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. So you don't have to be rich to call in. You can call in with your basic family law questions or issues that you might be thinking about, whether it's for yourself or perhaps you have some child or children who are planning to get married soon or planning to get divorced or heaven knows what, or maybe you want to enter into a domestic partnership with someone. I'm sure we can talk about this, so feel comfortable to call in if you like. If you've got some questions regarding child support or spousal support, also those are questions that I would ask you to call in about. So again, the number 1-415-841-4134. And as Chris was mentioning in the last minute or so, you know, it's a good idea to try to get some advice from an experienced family lawyer to really kind of give you something to think about before you tie the knot. And one way of doing this, of course, is to contact the lawyer referral service in your county, wherever that may be. One of the funders of this program is the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you have a legal problem, whether it's family law or whatever, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, San Mateo County Bar is also one of the funders of the program. San Mateo County Bar has a lawyer referral service also. You can call your own during normal business hours, 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. Call during normal business hours. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced in the area for you and set up a half an hour consultation in the attorney's office. And depending on what county you're in, it could be for a half an hour consultation, a low of $25 or a high of $35. The most expensive I've heard about is Sonoma County, where the lawyer referral service is $50 for half an hour. That's still a very good price, considering the expense, the expensiveness of lawyers. So we'll start with David. David, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. My question is that if you're married in the state of California, is a divorce recognized if you go outside of the state to have a divorce done for the simple reason of maybe it's least expensive that way? But really, my question is that as long as you are divorced, legally divorced in the United States, does it matter what state you're in?
So you're saying, David, if you got married in California and you went to Nevada to get a divorce, would that really give you a divorce throughout the United States, including California?
That's correct.
Yeah.
What? Yes, it would. We recognize those divorce judgments from any state. The issue that you would have is the residency requirement. Like, for example, in California, you need to be a resident, or at least one of the parties has to be a resident of the state for at least 6 months before filing for a divorce in California. So it would just depend on that other state's residency requirement. And if they didn't have any, then, yeah, you theoretically can go out there and file for divorce. But it's not just the filing of it. It's a court process. The other side would have the right to respond. If they agreed to the divorce, then one would be entered. If they didn't agree to it, then the case would have to go to a trial or other hearing. And
in California.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't. We have plenty of couples who are interstate, even international, and so we might have parts of the case being handled in one court and other parts being in another. California could dissolve the marriage, but maybe the property needs to be handled in another state. Just depends on where it was acquired. So these things get very complicated.
Okay, thank you very much.
David, thank you very much for calling. The number is 1-415-841-4134 for Your Legal Rights. Edith, welcome to the program.
Hi there, thank you.
Sure.
Now, I had a question about obtaining records from the court. I recently settled my divorce in 2010, and it was an uncontested divorce, and I had a full legal and physical custody of my 7-year-old son. And I was recently brought back to court by my ex-husband under false allegations. And basically, a mediator pushed to have joint legal and joint physical custody of our 7-year-old son. And they succeeded in doing that. And they did not look into the domestic violence allegations that I brought forth to the court. They basically ignored it. And I'm wanting to get a hold of the mediator's records because I filled out the intake form and clearly stated to them there was a history of domestic violence and my ex did have weapons. And they never told me that I could meet separately without my ex-husband's presence during the mediation appointment. And therefore, I'm trying to get a hold of these records. And they told me that I need to subpoena the court. Is that true?
Well, yeah, so you're trying to understand what the mediator's qualifications were or training?
I don't know. They were basically assigned, she was basically assigned to our case. And, you know, I was working with an attorney on a limited scope basis, mm-hmm. and she did a really poor job of representing me and providing me advice as to how to proceed in my case. And I've been trying to, you know, get copies of these records, but I was told that what happens in mediation, you know, is private and then you need to subpoena the court, even though I'm a party in the matter, which I was a little confused about.
Yeah, the custody mediation, the term is used differently in different counties. The traditional mediation is confidential, and, you know, whatever was discussed can't be, you know, brought up in court. There are some counties, though, called recommending counties, where they would have a mediator meet with the parties and sometimes talk to the child as well. And if the parties weren't able to come to an agreement, that so-called mediator would then come and testify in court as to their recommendations. We're now changing that term and not calling them mediators anymore because it's just not right to call them that. What it sounds like in your case is that, you know, the court apparently made a decision without considering all the evidence. And so you would want to try to go back to court and ask the judge to look at the domestic violence evidence that you have and make a different decision. And rather than focusing on the mediator and whether they did a good job or not, really the judge is the decision maker, and you'd want to bring your case back before the court. And there's a variety of ways of doing that to make sure that they're hearing your evidence. And you can make a motion, you know, to modify the order. You can make a motion for a rehearing, possibly. You could even appeal. And there are, you know, protections for victims of domestic violence. And if that is a factor that the court, you know, must consider when determining custody if domestic violence occurred. And if the court didn't consider that evidence, then, you know, it really deserves going back and having a new hearing so the court is making a decision that's not going to place you or your child in any harm's way.
Chris, in a situation such as Edith is talking about, every county now has a family law facilitator's office. Do you feel that she may get some assistance by contacting them?
You know, you might. You know, it just depends on how helpful the staff is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can, you know, deal with setting up maybe a new mediation appointment. But once the court's already made a decision, it may require filing new papers to get back, you know, in line here.
They could help with the filing of new papers, could they not, or not?
There is a self-help center at most courts, and that's where I would go to the self-help center because these, procedurally, there's correct ways of doing things and there's just wrong ways of doing things. So I think you need to maybe go to the self-help center, maybe, you know, contact a lawyer in your area, maybe a different one than you used before, and, you know, have them take a look at the paperwork and let you know what is the right way to get back before the judge so they can hear this evidence that you have of domestic violence.
Edith, what county was your divorce in?
This is in San Francisco, and I have been to the self-help center, Family Law Self-Help Center, and I have also looked online on the California Court Documents website to do the documents myself.
Well, let me do this. Edith, we've got a lot of other people who want to talk with Chris.
Okay.
Let me suggest, have you contacted the lawyer referral service for the San Francisco County Bar?
Yes, I have.
Have you? Okay, well, you've done a lot of work, and you're still not satisfied, right?
Well, I guess I was just unsure of, like, what to file and if there's a certain statute of limitations that I have to file this paperwork to reverse the order possibly.
Yeah, you're going to need to you know, actually sit down with a lawyer or somebody at that self-help center and show your paperwork, and so they can answer that, because there's no, without looking at the paperwork, I really couldn't, you know, tell you, you know, when the deadlines are and it's too it's very specific to your case, and I'd have to look at all those paperwork.
I think you better, you know, either get back to the lawyer referral service or the family law facilitator's office. Good luck to you, Edith. Thanks for calling. Sorry you're having the problem. All right, it's Your Legal Rights, 1-415-841-4134. My guest is Chris Melcher, chair-elect of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. He's also a certified family law specialist, certified family law specialist. Jumped a number of hoops to get that title. George, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm going through a divorce here in San Francisco. I own a small business. And my wife's lawyer is using our 2009 tax return and all of our financials to determine, you know, our payments to her, child support, and all that. And that was our best year for the company. 2010 has been horrible.
Mm.
How can I...
Do you have a lawyer, George?
No.
Oh, that's
no,
not.
I've had some advice from some lawyers through the lawyer referral service, but right now, I have an appointment coming up in June.
What, in court?
In court.
Yeah.
And I would like to just, you know, say, you know, hey, this forensic accountant still hasn't come forward with any conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
It's well into 2011. Can't you please use my 2010 as a basis? And because I'm going to go out of business.
Sure. Well, this is a problem we see all the time. I mean, and it's basically cherry picking, where one spouse will want to pick, you know, the best year possible and have everything based on, you know, 2009, which is your best year. And, you know, you want to use the last year, 2010. I think you have the better argument here just based on what you're telling me. We're going to look at the last years of, income to set support. And the reason why we're going to do that is because we need to predict basically what your income is going to be in the future, because you're going to be paying support in the future. You're not paying support on the money you made in 2009, you're paying support on the money you're making now and going forward. So we have to look at some period of time in the past that reflects what you reasonably will be making in the future. And going back to some year that was your peak year, that, you know, there's been a downturn since then, is not realistic. It's not reflective of what your current income is and what your ability to pay support is going to be. We typically are going to look at the last year. If you have your 2010 tax return and all that data is there, there's no reason not to use it. And again, most judges will see that this is just a cherry picking, where they're trying to pick the best numbers possible.
Mm-hmm.
You want to provide full detail to the other side into the court, so they have confidence in your numbers, because there's a lot of people going through divorce who all of a sudden have, you know, low income. And so you want to be able to show and explain why your income is different now than it was in 2009. You know, maybe it was costs are higher, you lost an important customer, you know, whatever those reasons are, explain that. Don't assume that the judge is just going to believe you. You need to build credibility and present your case in a convincing way, so they're going to use current income rather than past income to set support.
Chris, I know that there is has developed in the last recent years a process where someone can retain an attorney only for a limited part of a case. With respect to George's appearance, which is going to be sometime this month, do you suggest that he might want to see a family lawyer to try to get help? Not obviously a family lawyer, I presume, is not going to come in just for one hearing, but to help George get prepared for this hearing?
Absolutely. You know, you should be getting advice, having somebody look over your paperwork, somebody that's familiar with these kind of issues, because it's really a crossover between the law and accounting. And, you know, your lawyer needs to understand how to present financial statements, how businesses work, and to put that in language that the judge is going to understand. I don't think you necessarily need to have a lawyer standing by your side in court. That could actually send the wrong message. I mean, your position is that you can't afford to pay all the support.
I'm paying for my wife's lawyer.
Right, we know that.
I'm paying for the forensic accountant. I can't afford my own lawyer.
Right, right.
Well, and that's a real issue. If you can't afford your own lawyer, you should not be ordered to pay your wife's lawyer. You know, that's just wrong. And on top of that, like I say, just from an appearance standpoint, you know, if you have some expensive lawyer standing next to you, it sort of sends an inconsistent message that, you know, you can't afford to pay the support. So what I would recommend is, you know, meeting with somebody who's qualified that can go over these things with you, get your paperwork in order, make a convincing argument in writing, because most of these cases are decided, you know, based on the paperwork anyway. So present all that stuff, go into court, and, you know, and argue it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I had one more issue, if you may. You can cut me off if you want, but she also has a restraining order against me, false allegations of abuse of our son.
Mm.
And the social workers have come out and met me and said there's no basis for the restraining order. There's nothing wrong with the son. There's no history. There's, you know, but yet the restraining order is still in force. And I'm wondering, is there some way that the restraining orders have a certain limitation before there's a hearing?
Well, George, let me ask you this. Have the social workers, have they prepared some kind of a report that they will give to you or submit to the court?
Yeah, they have. They have.
So would the family law judge have a copy of this report that you're talking about?
They will, yeah. The new one hasn't come out. When the first report came out and said there's no basis, these allegations, there's no basis for these allegations, at the hearing they came up with another issue and said that they have some other issue. So the judge postponed the hearing.
Okay.
So those workers could look over the other issue. And now it's been 2 months since they've seen my son.
So is the matter regarding the restraining order, is that in the family court or is that in some other court?
I think it's the same judge.
Is it the same judge? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck to you, George.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
But I think Chris's idea of you're getting some help from an attorney just to help you prepare yourself, make sure the paperwork is correct, and prepare yourself so that when you go into court and you're representing yourself, you know what you're doing. So good luck.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guest is Chris Melcher, chair-elect of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. He's also a certified family law specialist. The number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. By the way, we will do our next Call a Lawyer night in another 3 weeks. That will be, I think, the 22nd of June. I believe that's when it is. That's when we'll do our Call a Lawyer night. In case you want to have some questions and want to talk to an attorney off the air, you might want to jot down the number, if you don't know it, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917 for June 22nd. And that same evening, we'll have the State Bar President here, Bill Haber, here with us to tell us what's been going on at the State Bar and what his projects have been. And Maggie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
This is Maggie. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I have a question. My brother is in a domestic, he lives with his girlfriend and they have a daughter of 5 years. They are not married and they never have been, largely to protect himself thus far. He makes over $100,000 a year, is the sole supporter of the family, and the mother has never supported herself and doesn't really care for the child. She just sends the child to daycare. He's now meeting with a therapist who definitely thinks he needs to get with a lawyer this week, start figuring this out, because she's basically giving him an ultimatum to marry her within 6 months. He wants to protect himself and his child. He wants nothing less than 50%
custody, if not full time. But seeing as he's, you know, the unwed father, I know that often it's in the favor of the mother, but kind of wondering if you have any advice on the direction he should go in. And I should mention he lives in New York State.
Okay, well, I don't know exactly how it works in New York, but most courts will set custody based on how the parties shared time or responsibilities with the child prior to the separation. And so, you know, if New York is anything like California, the best protection that your brother can have is to make sure that he is spending as much time as he possibly can with his child, that he's going to all the doctor's appointments, that he's involved with the school, he's doing the homework, you know, I mean, just demonstrating that he is a hands-on dad. The dads that really get the short end of the stick, I think, is ones that are, you know, decided to be working full-time, mm-hmm. so their spouse can stay at home and take care of the child. And that was an agreement, you know, or an arrangement that's made by those two partners, you know, for the better of the family. But on separation, the dad in that instance gets stuck with the nights and weekend schedule. And I think people should have the right to, you know, readjust their lives if they're no longer going to be living as one family unit.
Right.
But, you know, until that day comes, you know, making sure that he is there and hands-on and involved is going to get him the best protection or not. Whether he's married or not makes absolutely no difference at all, at least in California, on a custody decision. It's just completely not considered.
And what are her, I mean, if she, you know, threatens, for the lack of a better word, to take the child by herself, I mean, what rights does he have then?
Well, you know, in California, that both, I mean, unless there's an order, both parents have the right to control their child, and but they can't, you know, like abduct the child, and that would be against the law. You know, that doesn't sound like a great relationship, and that they really should be working on those things before they, you know, would ever consider marriage.
Yeah, and you know, to be honest, he's only in the relationship because he has so much fear of losing his daughter, who he cares so much about. I mean, he's been living with her ever since, just to not rock the boat because of the child.
Well, he should be, you know, you may want to advise him to, you know, start saving. If she's sending emails to him that are nasty or threatening, or voicemail messages, text messages, you know, anything like that, that he should be saving those things as, you know, evidence to show a judge what, you know, her personality is really like, or character, you know, if they ever did have a dispute.
Yes.
Well, Maggie, thank you very much for calling. Yeah, take care. I presume, as all states, every state has to be able to know what you should be doing. Every state, I presume, has a lawyer referral, and that's something that Maggie might want to suggest to her brother. It doesn't sound like, frankly, I didn't get the impression that the brother had a lawyer at this point. Did you, Chris, or not?
No, it didn't sound like it.
Yeah. I think he needs to get some professional advice, don't you?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you know, it's one thing to, you know, lose your life savings, or have to pay a bunch of support, or lose a house. Though those are hard enough, but losing a child, you know, that is an awful consequence of going through one of these cases. And so, you know, understanding how the court makes the decisions, you know, basically separating fact from fiction. There's a lot of people who, you know, think it's going to turn out one way or just completely wrong. And going and getting a little advice is going to be well worth it.
Yeah. So, Maggie, if your brother does not have an attorney at this point, or has not seen an attorney, certainly try to get him to do so. He certainly, with the income you're telling us that he makes, he certainly can afford to do that, and get some basic advice on how to deal with this. So we're just about over with the program at this point. Chris, do you have some final comments for us in terms of those people who might be thinking of either getting married or thinking of getting divorced?
Well, my advice is, you know, really that people, a lot of people, I think, get divorced for frivolous reasons, and to really try and invest in that relationship and keep it alive, look at the positive aspects of it, communicate, respect each other, you know, and build that relationship rather than destroying it. But if that's just not possible, to get some advice. A lot of people can handle their divorce by themselves, but go out and look at these free resources that are online. There's so much out there. And, you know, or talk to a lawyer, see if you can get a free consultation or maybe one of these low-cost consultations. Get some help, because it's very difficult to go through this by yourself.
You mentioned to me when we were getting ready to do the program that a part of the problem, aside from lack of communication, part of the problem was that many people you have found feel that the other spouse doesn't appreciate them. Talk briefly about that, would you? You got about 1 minute, if you would.
That's where most of the problem comes from. You know, just the other spouse doesn't always understand, you know, what each other are doing. You know, if one's working and one's staying at home, I mean, those are both equally important contributions, and the spouses or partners need to recognize that, acknowledge that. Otherwise, people feel undeserved. They feel that they're being taken advantage of. They're not being appreciated, and that leads to the resentment, anger, cheating, all of these, you know, maybe even abuse. So, you know, I think getting out there, communicating, knowing that, you know, or telling people that you love them and appreciate them is so vital.
And just try to communicate, right?
Well, that's it. A lot of people end up shutting down.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, I thank you very much. And I want to mention again the book you mentioned, Prenups for Lovers by Dubin, D-U-B-I-N, and the Court Systems Self-Help Center website is www.courtinfo.ca.gov/self-help. Chris, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I hope you have a very good year when you become the chair of the family law section. It's been very nice having you on the program.
Thanks, Chuck.
Chris is a certified family law specialist. He's a partner in the Woodland Hills, that's Los Angeles County law firm of Walzer and Melcher. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and by the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, if you bought a car, a new car, and it's still under the original warranty, but you got a lot of problems with it, we're going to be talking about the federal lemon law. We'll also be talking about the Better Business Bureau's Auto Line program. My guests are lemon law attorneys Mark Anderson and Ron Brody. So join us then. Thanks very much for joining us on this segment of Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.